And I hear everybody say that things are different today. Was it in the outside? Or was it only yesterday? I saw you standing in the rain. And nothing's been the same since you came around. You came around, round, round, yeah. I've been walking on the sun. I just closed my eyes.
Greetings and salutations. Welcome back to the Tools of Ignorance podcast. Yes, I'm sure you can't believe your eyes and or ears because we have had a rather long hiatus. We apologize for that. Life got in the way. But we're back. We're back in the saddle. We're happy to be here. And, well, I don't want to speak for my partner in crime, Mr. Hudson Malinsky. So, Hudson, how you doing?
I'm fantastic, Jonah. It has been a long time. Things happened on each of our ends, and then things happened on each of our ends again, and here we are. But we are recording this show finally, and we have mounds and mounds of things to get through. So, Jonah, I guess we could do small talk for a little bit more, because it's been so long. I was going to transition right into it. But, Jonah, describe for our listeners your handsomeness right now.
Oh, man. We're recording early in the morning. I don't even have pants on. It's like a freaking circus up in here.
Excellent.
Like, if you walked into my apartment, you'd think it's a magic show going on. But, yeah, that's okay. That's the end of the small talk.
Okay. So the Jays made a trade, Jonah, with the Marlins.
Yeah. Actually, I think they just incorporated the Marlins, like, as a company. They acquired all of their assets and took on all of their payroll. And now it's just one baseball conglomerate. But, yeah, no, seriously, the Jays executed, you know, what really is a franchise-changing deal with the Miami Marlins. Mm-hmm. A number of weeks back, Alex Anthopoulos went out and he acquired Josh Johnson, Jose Reyes, Mark Burley, Emilio Bonifacio, and John Buck from the Marlins in exchange for a bevy of youthful assets, including Henderson Alvarez, you know, Escobar, prospects like Nicolino, Jake Marisnik, Anthony Desclafini. There was a lot of talent exchanged, a lot of money exchanged, and it was without a doubt, unequivocally, the biggest trade in the history of the Blue Jays. And that's not to, you know, belittle the Alomar and Carter deal back in the early 90s, but just in terms of the sheer magnitude of the deal, this is massive, and it immediately changes the complexion of the Blue Jays. I mean, coming into this offseason, their rotation was in a complete state of disarray. Only two guys were guaranteed rotation spots in Ricky Romero and Brandon Morrow. And frankly, even those guys represent, you know, fairly big question marks. And now they've completely overhauled their rotation. They have Josh Johnson and Mark Burley now. They've replaced Yunel Escobar, who they became disillusioned with last year after his underwhelming performance and the eye black fiasco. Now they have one of the most exciting up-the-middle players in the game in Jose Reyes. They have a utility guy in Emilio Bonifacio who can steal a heck of a lot of bases. He can play a number of positions. You know, they have John Buck who will now... the catching situation in Toronto is rather nebulous just because I anticipate that they'll make another move to perhaps thin themselves out at the catcher position because it is an area of strength and, you know, they have possibilities on the trade market there. But, yeah, it completely overhauled the Blue Jays, and they took on, you know, upwards of $150 million in payroll for the next couple seasons. But it was a truly monumental deal, and I'm going to throw it over to you and just say, you know, what was your take when you first saw it break?
It was crazy. I have a good number of contacts with the Marlins, and, you know, the situation down there isn't good, but there are a lot of talented people working there, and I really liked what the Marlins did, and I really liked it for the Jays, obviously, because the Jays are in this sort of this spot where you kind of feel like it has to happen. It's been so long, it's been so many years of, hey, they could be kind of good this year, maybe this is the year, and then it just isn't. And I think the Jays had to do something like this last year. they didn't take that shot on Yu Darvish. They didn't go out and sign a Pujols or sign a Reyes. They didn't make that move that said, you know, we really think we're going to do it this year. And this year they did. So, you know, that's a huge statement, and it's huge for the Blue Jays. But I really like it for the Marlins because the Marlins now start to have this incredibly deep minor league system, not a lot of commitment at the major league level in terms of contracts. So, you know, I could kind of see it being a much faster turnaround than what they had going for them with, you know, a bunch of guys whose contracts were kind of eh. The big thing in this deal for me is going to be the health of Josh Johnson going forward. Is Josh Johnson going to be able to stay healthy and be the pitcher that he's been, or is he going to continue to struggle with injury and struggle to stay on the mound? If that's the case, then this deal looks a lot different. I still like it for the Jays because, you know, there's just so many pieces that they added. I really like even Emilio Bonifacio, who might be one of the more unsung heroes in this trade, is a guy who can kind of play all over the field. Really good hit tool. I think he's a guy who can hit in the 280, 290 range consistently. Very, very fast player, and a guy who's up the middle when you need him to be. And so that, all of that combined with their next move, which was signing Melky Cabrera to a two-year, $16 million deal, it kind of makes the Jays look scary. And if Josh Johnson's healthy, they're that much scarier.
Yeah, they really are. And if you look at their lineup, you know, you look at the top of their lineup, and it probably projects to be Jose Reyes leading off, and then Melky, and then you have Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion, Brett Laurie. You look at 1 through 5, that's pretty imposing for opposing pitchers. That's a very, very solid top of the lineup. And then they have other guys at the bottom of the lineup, guys like J.P. Arencibia and Colby Rasmus, guys with power, not exceptional on base abilities, but certainly the ability to drive the ball out of the ballpark. And their lineup 1 through 9 is pretty intimidating. But you're absolutely right. Josh Johnson's health is going to be one of the central factors of this deal. And if he is unable to stay healthy, I think a lot of Jays fans will be skeptical that he opts to remain with the Blue Jays beyond 2013. And I think that's one of the things that are giving Jays fans, you know, sort of tempering their enthusiasm a little bit because, you know, he does have a history of shoulder problems. And, you know, that is definitely cause for concern because he's going to be, he really is going to step in and be the leader of this rotation, a leader that they really haven't had since Roy Halladay was traded to the Phillies a number of years ago. And I think the other thing that Jays fans are concerned about, certainly the pundits in the blogosphere were concerned about the financial commitment and how it could be somewhat cumbersome a few years down the road. But if you look at the contract, the financial commitments beyond 2015, in 2016, they only have $22 million guaranteed in payroll. You know, a lot of players that are under contract for the next few years, for the immediate future, have buyouts. You know, relatively inexpensive buyouts by the time we get to 2016. You know, if Ricky Romero isn't able to figure himself out and he's unable to return to that level that he performed at, you know, for the past few seasons, excluding last season, you know, he has a $600,000 buyout in 2016. So those are probably options that they'll seriously consider. So, you know, I think that the concern over the overextending themselves financially might be a tad overblown because, you know, $22 million by 2016, that's, you know, that's only a modest commitment. So it is very exciting. And as you mentioned, from the Marlins' perspective, say what you will about Jeffrey Loria, you know, they acquired quite a bit of young talent. Guys like Jake Marisnyk, he was the number two prospect in the organization. You know, Kevin Goldstein, when he was writing up his prospect rankings last year, he said he could project to be a 2020 center fielder who plays plus defense, and that could even be light. He could do more with the stick. And guys like Nicolino was one of the Lansing three, one of Toronto's top three pitching prospects, and he was definitely pretty much universally considered to be, you know, have the lowest ceiling among those three pitchers, the other two being Aaron Sanchez and Noah Syndergaard. But, you know, he was certainly a very exciting prospect that Jays fans, that he was certainly within the consciousness of Jays Jays fans and not even diehard Jays fans, because, you know, the organization had really done a job in marketing those three guys, and he was definitely a prospect that we were looking forward to see materialize. So, you know, obviously Jeffrey Loria has drawn the ire of fans in the Miami area, and I don't blame them one bit for that. But, you know, if you look past it a little bit and try to get a little bit of perspective, from a baseball point of view, it actually wasn't too bad of a deal for Miami. And I think, you know, for the Blue Jays, it was unequivocally a win.
Mm-hmm. I'll agree with you on that. And sticking with the Blue Jays, but moving on from this trade, you mentioned briefly the catcher situation that now I believe they have four catchers on their 40-man. The thing that's kind of scary about, you know, responding to this trade is that there's still so much talent in the minor leagues for the Blue Jays, and if they wanted to, there's really nothing stopping them from flipping a couple of minor leaguers and doing something else that's crazy. They could very easily pull off another kind of trade. There are some options out there. Matt Garza is a guy. R.A. Dickey, if you know, who knows what's going to happen with him and the Mets in that 1 year that's left there. But looking specifically at this catcher situation, here you have Travis d'Arnaud and J.P. Arencibia and John Buck. What do you do there? Do you flip one of those guys? Do you flip d'Arnaud to the highest bidder? Do you get a different bench piece with Arencibia or Buck? Or that's just, I'm very curious as to what's going to happen in that scenario and how that's going to play out.
Yes, yeah, so am I. It's a very intriguing situation, and I think one thing you have to accept is that you're not going to be able to move John Buck. He's a backup catcher who makes $6 million. He has virtually no trade value, so I think you're somewhat resigned to have him start the season as your backup. So your question is, are you going to move Arencibia or Travis d'Arnaud? Now, I mean, the Jays have been grooming Travis d'Arnaud for, you know, a couple of years now since they finally managed to acquire him, and he's been marketed by the team like freaking crazy. Everyone is really, really excited to see Travis d'Arnaud, and you look at the numbers that he's put up in the minor leagues over the past couple seasons, and they are just exceptional. Really, really crazy, and, you know, a lot of people believe he can be a franchise catcher, and, I mean, don't get me wrong, J.P. Arencibia is really, really well-liked in Toronto with the fans. He's really popular, and from a baseball point of view, he's a catcher with, you know, good power numbers and, you know, weak on base abilities, and, you know, at best average defense. I think it's pretty obvious that Travis d'Arnaud has more trade value than J.P. Arencibia, despite the fact that he's never played a major league game. So if I'm Alex Stanthopoulos, I'm probably trying to shop J.P. Arencibia, because, I mean, I think the understanding is that Travis d'Arnaud is going to be your catcher as soon as he's ready to do so. And there's nothing to suggest that he's not ready to do so now. Obviously, last season, he missed the last few months of the season with a knee injury. But, you know, it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that Travis d'Arnaud is going to be the catcher of this team as soon as he's ready. So, you know, going into the winter meetings, I think the first or second thing on Alex Anthopoulos' mind is probably trying to finagle a deal for J.P. Arencibia that brings over probably some rotational depth, because, you know, beyond our projected fifth starter, who's going to be Jay Happ as it currently stands, Chad Jenkins is probably the next guy to get the call should one of our pitchers, you know, get injured for an extended period of time. So, yeah, in my mind, I see them shopping J.P. Arencibia pretty aggressively, because I don't think that, given how much time they've invested into Travis d'Arnaud and what they went through to get him, and how central I think they perceive him to be with respect to the team's future, I think that Arencibia is the guy, sort of the odd man out.
Okay, now, the thing with Travis d'Arnaud, every time somebody sees him, it's, oh, my goodness, I love this kid. He's got it all. He's going to be a star. But he really hasn't been on a field that often. You look at the past couple of years, he's always had a significant injury, really ever since the Jays acquired him. In 2010, he played 71 games. In 2011, he played 114 games, which is pretty standard, pretty much a full season. And then this year, only 67 games. And so we start to have this issue: is this guy going to be able to catch 120 games a year going forward? And say you trade J.P. Arencibia and you bring up Travis d'Arnaud, and he's not able to do that. He's sort of 70, 80 games every year. He's always got something bugging him, and then by the time he's 30, he can't be catching anymore. His body's just not able to handle the position. So that, I think, sort of throws this other dimension into the, should we go with d'Arnaud right now? Should we move Arencibia or just wait? So I'm curious to see how you will respond to that.
Yeah, durability has become a concern. And last year, I think it was an ACL injury, perhaps an MCL. But you look at his injury history, and they're not really related or recurring. It just seems like he seems to get hit by some kind of significant injury that's, you know, perhaps outside of his control. Or, you know what, perhaps it is a byproduct of the way he plays. But, you know, durability is a concern. And I think that's probably giving Alex Anthopoulos pause, too. Think about it. He's like, well, can we entrust, you know, 130 games behind the dish to a guy who's, you know, only played more than 100 games in the minor leagues in one season two times, and he's been in the minor leagues for 5 years. So, yeah, I think that is giving them pause, but ultimately I don't think it's going to be too much of a concern. I don't think it's going to be a huge impediment to them trying to trade J.P. Arencibia, just because, you know, you look at the talent and, you know, it's almost like playing scared. You can't go forwards anticipating that he's going to be hurt, you know, because he's managed to, you know, be unfortunate sustaining a couple of, I'll call them freak injuries, in his past, you know. Pardon me. So, yeah, I mean, durability is a factor that they're definitely going to consider when evaluating who to anoint that starting catcher for 2013 and how they go about exploring the trade market. But ultimately, I don't think that his injury history is going to prevent them from pursuing a trade for J.P. Arencibia.
Okay. Yeah. So I think unless you've got more on the Jays, we can sort of transition into another transaction, if you're okay with that.
I'm okay with that. I can deal with it.
It's going to be tough, but you'll be a trooper and make it happen.
I'm going to be a trooper, and with that, we'll say yesterday the Braves and the Angels brokered themselves a deal. The Braves sent over starting pitcher Tommy Hansen in exchange for hard-throwing reliever Jordan Walden. And you being the resident Angels expert, Hudson, what was your reaction? Because certainly on Twitter, the consensus was that there was a lot of surprise that the Braves would send over a pretty young starting pitcher, considered to have quite a bit of upside for a relief pitcher. So what were your thoughts?
My initial reaction is that the Braves have fallen out of touch with Tommy Hansen, and he's seen a significant dip in velocity over the past couple of years, and he's had shoulder issues, which are definitely huge red flags. But you look at him, he's still in his early 20s, he's still young. He is a starter, and in his worst season of his career this year, it was, you know, 4.48 ERA, a guy who's getting on the bump every fifth day. So at his floor, he's kind of that. He's kind of this over 4 ERA guy, strikes a lot of guys out, gives up a lot of home runs. The velocity's not where you'd like it to be, but hey, he's still 6'6". He's hiding the ball well. He's got the late release point. It's difficult to pick up the ball until it's in your face. The one thing, as a brief little sidebar, the thing that a lot of people said was Kazmir 2.0. The Angels acquired Scott Kazmir a couple years back, so they're familiar. The Angels fans are familiar with him. And what happened with Kazmir, it was he lost velocity, and that was basically it for him. But Scott Kazmir was 6 foot and kind of you saw it coming. If he ever loses velocity, he's probably done. And I don't think it's the same thing with Tommy Hansen. And Tommy Hansen's also a couple years younger than Scott Kazmir was when that happened. But the whole idea, even if he's a fourth or fifth starter, trading a pretty reckless late-inning guy is definitely justifiable. You just look at the fact that Tommy Hansen can be expected to go out and toss 150 to 200 innings next season, and Jordan Walden might give you 60. It's just very simple to see, especially given the Angels' needs, that this is definitely a win for the Angels so far.
Sure. Yeah, I totally agree with you on that. But the fact that Tommy Hansen is only 26 years old and his velocity has already been declining rather steadily over the past couple seasons. I think last year his average fastball was just under 90 miles an hour, and his home run rates climbed, dip in the strikeout rate and an increase in the walk rate. Is it sort of a guy who's trending in the wrong direction? Like, obviously, the fact that the Braves were so ready to part ways with him, I mean, doesn't that give you, you know, a little bit of trepidation towards where this guy is heading?
Yes, but I think that the Braves' non-hesitation or willingness to give him up is also a product of the depth that they've got. They have a couple of guys who have flirted with the big leagues and have been up and down for a few years that are very good prospects. And if they believe in those guys more so than they believe in Hansen, this, you know, it makes sense. But, you know, over the next couple of years, we're going to learn a lot about this deal. And I think Tommy Hansen, I think you have to bet on him at this point with everything the way that it is in baseball. And, you know, the relief pitcher in general is just such a very difficult thing to predict. And so at least with Hansen, there's some more reliable evidence to go back on and predict what's going to happen with him. But Jordan Walden, he could be really, really good, and this deal could make the Angels look silly. But I just don't bet on Jordan Walden being this kind of dominant, lights-out, eighth-inning, ninth-inning guy for several years at a time. And so when we put all of that together, I think it's a win for the Angels. But I totally acknowledge that it could definitely go in the opposite direction.
Well, how good is the Braves' bullpen right now? You have to think that on paper they have by far the best bullpen in the National League.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of scary to think that as an opposing hitter you might have to go into the eighth inning and face Jordan Walden, who's throwing 100 pretty regularly, and then in the ninth inning, Kimbrel, or even if they use Venters or Erico Flaherty, you know, there's no escaping it. It's all hard throwers that will strike you out. So it's kind of, if that bullpen stays healthy and can continue to be effective like it has been, and Jordan Walden gets back to where he was in 2011, that's a scary bullpen.
Well, it's terrifying, and it almost makes you think that maybe it makes sense that Tommy Hansen was expendable. They only need their starters to go six innings, mm-hmm. and then you have, you know, four potential relief studs who can close out the game for you.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting little thought there.
The other element to this all, and we'll talk about this move in a little bit more detail in a second, but rumor had it that the Braves were trying to avoid paying Tommy Hansen what he would have gotten in arbitration, which could be expected to be a little bit north of $4 million, because the Braves just dished out a ton of money for the most expensive BJ of all time. Yeah, I just said that.
You had to go for it, didn't you?
Yeah. I won't take credit for that, but I saw it somewhere else on the internet. But I said it. BJ Upton is now Brave.
He sure is.
Yeah.
That's a pretty exciting move.
Mm-hmm.
You look at BJ Upton's numbers, and he's an extremely dynamic player. He can be extremely frustrating. frustrating at times too, because I mean, if you know, if you look at his pedigree, he's often been characterized as a guy who doesn't hustle. He doesn't play 100% all the time. But you just look at his talent, his power, his speed, and it's really something to marvel at. I mean, for the past three seasons, he's been worth at least 3.3 wins above replacement. He's had a couple of seasons over four wins. I mean, obviously, the strikeouts are frustrating. And at times, especially last season, his on-base abilities were, you know, left people rolling their eyes. But BJ Upton's a very, very exciting player. He's still relatively young, and, you know, he was arguably one of the best available outfielders on the free agent market outside of, you know, Josh Hamilton. So, yeah, I think it was a very exciting move for the Braves, and I don't know what your thoughts were, but I like the deal for the Braves.
I like the deal for the Braves, but I am cautious of it. Here's the best-case scenario. In 2007, as a 22-year-old, B.J. Upton got on base at a .386 clip. He hit 24 home runs. He stole 22 bases. And since then, he's gotten a little bit better on the base paths, and he's also shown a little bit more power. But the on-base ability is sort of declined steadily over the years. And so last year, .298 on base, which is just awful. Probably also a product of the fact that pitchers seem to be just better over the past couple of years in terms of the numbers. But getting back to the original point, he could be a star, and he could be a star for the next 5 years, and this could be an awesome deal for the Braves. Or he could be terrible. I think that going forward with him, there's a chance something goes wrong in terms of an injury, and if he loses his speed at all, what kind of player is he? You know, a guy who can kind of play center field if he loses the speed. You know, he's got the instincts to make it work, but, you know, he's going to need to get on base is basically the bottom line here. If he loses the power, if he loses the speed, the on-base ability is just not going to cut it. Won't make him really probably even replacement level. So it's a big risk, but there's good reason to bet on the tools. If you look at players as they enter their late 20s and early 30s, they often start to capitalize on their physical gifts. So it makes sense, and I can definitely see it going in that direction. I could see this being an awesome deal, and B.J. Upton being a superstar and MVP type player, but I could also see it going in the total opposite direction and being looked at as a terrible deal 5 or 6 years down the line.
Yeah, well, definitely. Yeah, I mean, in the immediate future, I think that it's going to work out well for the Braves, because I don't see his speed diminishing significantly in the next couple of years. I mean, he's only 28 years old, but I couldn't agree with you more. Yeah, he's a guy whose success is, you know, inextricably linked with his ability to steal bases, you know, and cover ground in the outfield with his speed and certainly with his power. You know, you even look at a guy like Carl Crawford when he came over to the Red Sox in 2011. I mean, he's had a pretty disastrous tenure with the Red Sox so far in, you know, two seasons, even though he only played 31 games last year. But, I mean, in 2011, he only stole 18 bases in 130 contests. And, I mean, he's outside of one aberration in 2008, he's never had a year where he stole less than 40 bases. And you look at how his value has absolutely plummeted, right? I mean, in 2011, he was only worth, you know, 0.2 wins above replacement. So, you know, you could easily, that could easily be a cautionary tale for B.J. Upton and what happens to, you know, guys with power and speed when their speed begins to diminish. It could be quite troublesome for the Braves a few years down the road. But for right now, I think, like you, I'm cautiously optimistic. But what I wonder is, I mean, you look at the spike in his isolated power over the past few years and sort of the corresponding decrease in on-base percentage. And do you think that he's just the guy who's changed his approach? He's tried to become more of a power hitter. And I mean, only with modest success, I would say, because he's not a real power hitter, but he's also sacrificed quite a bit of on-base percentage, you know, for that spike in isolated power. So, I mean, do you think he's changed his approach at the plate?
I would guess that's the case. You look at, just say, 2008, 9 home runs, 37 doubles, 383 on base. 2009, 11 home runs, 33 doubles, 313 on base. And then the next season, 2010, 18 home runs, 38 doubles, 322 on base. Then started to pick up again, or really pick up in 2011, 23 home runs, 27 doubles, 331 on base. And then last year, 28 home runs, 29 doubles, but a 298 on base. So it is weird. Certainly can't totally conclude that that's what's contributing to this, but it is a viable explanation for what happened. So that might be something that can be fixed. But when you look at guys who have issues with approach, typically they figure it out at a younger age. And that's what's kind of weird about Upton. You look at 2008, he walked 97 times. And he had also cut his strikeouts down significantly from 2007 to 2008, even though he played fewer games. But now it's this season he struck out 169 times. The K rate is very significant, and the approach it must be an issue. Yeah, it must be something that he's going to have to tinker to get the most out of his tools.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, the K rate is always going to be high with BJ Upton. I think he's established that with very little doubt. But the other thing that's kind of concerning is that you look at his rate at which he offers at pitches outside of the zone, and in 2012, he set a new standard for himself at 32.7%. You know, that's 10% higher than his career average. So, yeah, it's sort of a reverse kind of development where guys typically, you know, refine and improve their approaches as they get older, but it's sort of been the opposite for BJ Upton, who last year, you know, only walked in 7.1% of his plate appearances, and that's outside of 2006 when he played 50 games. That's a career low for him. So there are definitely some red flags with BJ Upton, but, you know, if you want a decent BJ, you're going to have to pay the money. And on that note, we're going to head into our first break, and when we come back, we'll be talking more off-season shenanigans, including the Yankees' deals with Andy Pettitte and Mariano Rivera, and a another Yankee signing with a different team. So stick around. We'll be right back. You're what I need.
Getting close to anyone now that I'm alone.
Hello and welcome back to the podcast. Briefly, before we start talking about baseball again, we'd just like to remind you that you can send us your emails. You can ask us questions about baseball, about life, philosophy, really anything. We're all ears. You can do that at toolsofignorance11@gmail.com. Once again, toolsofignorance11@gmail.com. And we're not sure if we have any emails. We do have at least one, but we may read those later in the show, depending upon how many of you guys flock to us. Flock is not the correct word. But Jonah, so baseball.
Yeah, I'm flocking over here.
Yeah, I'm making up words.
Yeah. You fastidio.
Hey, I resent that.
That's true. This is supposed to be
a clean podcast with no talk of BJ and whatever. So the Yankees have signed a couple of pitchers, one a relief pitcher, one a starting pitcher.
And they're both old. Shock.
Yeah, they're both really, really old. But they're both really, really good. And they've both been really, really good for a long time. Andy Pettitte and Mariano Rivera signing one-year deals to come back with the Yankees. any reaction initially from you on either of those?
Good for the Yankees for giving them sort of what they wanted. I think both of those guys have built up, you know, enough good faith with the organization that they should, you know, the organization's in a position to give them sort of what they ask for, especially in the case of Rivera, who's, you know, anyone who's listening to this podcast knows what Mariano Rivera has done and what he's meant to the Yankees organization. So good on them for bringing him back. I'm, you know, despite the fact that I support a team that plays in the American League East, it's always exciting to see Mariano Rivera pitch just because he's so damn good at his job. He really is a master of pitching. And, you know, he's a no-doubt first ballot Hall of Famer. So it's always, you know, fun to watch those guys play. And in the case of Pettit, the Yankees needed rotation help. There's no question about it. And outside of CeCe Sabathia, you know, there's not a whole lot of reliability. You know, you got guys like Nova and Hughes, and those guys don't inspire a whole lot of confidence. So I think this was crucial for the Yankees to bring back Andy Pettit. He looked really, really good in 12 starts last year. He was sensational. And even the year before that, well, I mean, he missed 2011, but back in 2010, he was good as well. You know, he was quite effective as a starting pitcher. And you know what Andy Pettit's going to give you. He's a competitor. He goes out there and gives you a chance to win. Doesn't strike out a whole lot of guys, but, you know, he's a fairly crafty left-handed guy with a great pickoff move and doesn't walk a ton of guys. So, yeah, I think this was big for the Yankees. And I think that having both those guys on their roster will help, you know, stabilize that organization a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. And I can kind of leave it at that because I'm not sure how much more I can stress that they are both awesome and that this is very good for the Yankees. The interesting thing that I'll mention is Mo Rivera coming back from an injury. It will be interesting to see how he can do that and never really having to do that before to see if he holds up and is the same Mariano Rivera that we know and love. I would expect him to be, but that's something to monitor as we approach the season here. But there was a Yankee who is no longer a Yankee, who is now the highest paid player in franchise history, and that's Russell Martin, who signed a 2-year, $17 million deal with the Pittsburgh Pirates. That is... I'm not sure if it's the highest ever, but it's the highest at least of the last 20 years, which is totally, totally baffling to me. What's your what are your impressions of the Russell Martin signing?
Yeah, it was pretty shocking to me as well, just considering sort of the frustrating year he had offensively last year. You know, he flirted with the Mendoza line for most of the season, finished with an average just over 200 at 211. He showed some good power, but I think this deal had a lot to do with his abilities as a catcher. And if you look at some of the defensive metrics, it suggests that he's, you know, he is a very, very good catcher defensively. His framing abilities are, you know, often lauded by a lot of people in the game. But it is a little bit surprising, just considering, you know, where the Pirates are as an organization. And I mean, you know, Russell Martin's 29 years old and he'll be 30 by the time the season starts. And I mean, you know, some of his numbers are trending in the wrong direction. The strikeout rate is up a little bit and the on-base percentage is, you know, down significantly from where it's been in the past. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to me, it was a little bit surprising just in terms of how much money they gave him. But I mean, you know, that was me. What were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think you look at guys who receive 2-year, $17 million contracts, they're usually a little bit better than Russell Martin. That doesn't make this a bad deal, but I look at, you know, Melky Cabrera is a guy who is coming off of two really, really good seasons, and obviously his value is greatly diminished by the fact that he is tested positive and all this stuff has happened with him, but still, you're looking at what market value says Russell Martin should be worth. It isn't really 2 years, $17 million, but I do respect the Pirates' decision to go out and and get an everyday catcher when they really didn't feel, obviously, that they had a better option in-house or even on the trade market. So I respect it. I am not sure I would do the same thing. But there are also things that we can't really quantify about catching, like the relationship that a pitcher has with a catcher is a huge thing. And if Russell Martin is the kind of guy who you would like to have catching your young pitchers coming up, then this makes more sense. And if you think that he can make pitchers better and get the best out of pitchers, it makes more sense. So, you know, you could call it a bad deal or even worse than that, especially because it's still a very short term. It's a lot of money, but it is a very short term. But I'm just not sure I would have done the same thing.
Yeah, it is quite a bit of money, but, I mean, you spoke about the importance of intangibles, and, I mean, yeah, a lot of things are very difficult to quantify, but from all accounts, Russell Martin is really a sensational clubhouse
right.
guy, extremely hard worker, and he's probably a guy with a work ethic that you want to rub off on a relatively young team. So I think that that could have factored into their decision and certainly their generosity in terms of dollars. But, yeah, I mean, I think it could work out well. He's probably not quite as I think that his on-base struggles last year were something of an aberration, and I think he's proven himself to be a better hitter than that. But, yeah, it was quite a bit of money, and the fact that he's making more than Melky, it's a little bit surprising to me, but, you know, it could work out well, but, you know, the Pirates – they could regret giving that kind of money to a guy who's coming off his, you know, arguably one of his worst offensive seasons.
Yeah, and, you know, there's still, you know, there's a decent chance that there's more left in Russell Martin. So we'll follow that. But moving on yet again, there was kind of a bizarre deal. I think it's bizarre. I'm not sure if you feel the same way, but The Twins traded everyday center fielder Denard Span for Alex Meyer, who is a prospect that I really like, in a one-for-one deal with the Washington Nationals. And so now Denard Span is going to be the center fielder for the Washington Nationals. It gives the Nats a ton more flexibility as to what they're going to do with Worth and Harper and Roger Bernardina. And the Twins add a powerful arm to their minor league system. What do you think of this deal when it went down?
Yeah, I mean, I was a little bit surprised. But for the Twins, I really like this deal. Mm-hmm. You know, Alex Meyer, you look at his pedigree, he's a first-round pick. You know, he went 23rd overall to the Nationals in 2011. And you look at the numbers that he put up in his first year of professional baseball, and they were quite impressive. I thought that they were quite good. You know, he threw 25... he made 25 appearances, rather, and threw almost 130 innings in 2012 between low A and high A. And he averaged, you know, more than a strikeout per inning, had a whip of 1.1. And you look at where the Twins are as an organization, and they are just terrible at the major league level. They weren't going anywhere last year, and in the next few years. And pitching was, you know, is one of their biggest areas of weakness. I mean, Scott Diamond was their ace last year, not to disparage Scott Diamond because he's one of probably the best pitcher to ever come out of Guelph, Ontario. But, yeah, I mean, for the Twins, I like this deal a lot. You know, they have a young, high-ceiling arm that could, you know, be a big part of their rotation in the next few years. He's under team control for quite a bit of time now, and, you know, they're liquidating assets at the major league level because they don't really have any use for those guys, you know, in the immediate future. So I like it for the Twins, and what was your take on it?
I like it for the Twins. It just seems, I don't know, it seems like an odd move to make, trading an everyday center fielder in the middle of an offseason for that kind of package. It seems like they didn't really leverage it as much as they possibly could have. But, you know, even so, I do get it. Alex Meyer is a fantastic prospect. The interesting thing to me that a couple of VP guys were talking about was the whole idea that the Twins' typical arm doesn't really look like Alex Meyer. And that's sort of changing drastically over the past couple of years. If we look at how they're drafting and the pitchers that they're bringing into the system now, you see a lot more 95-mile-an-hour fastballs and buckling curveballs than you do 90-mile-an-hour fastballs and 81-mile-an-hour changeups and elite control. So it seems to be that there's a shifting philosophy in terms of pitching, which may be a result of Terry Ryan being back in Minnesota. But, you know, overall, this deal makes sense. It just seems, for some reason, it seems weird to me. I'm not sure. It's just, you have this, I just don't know. It's an everyday center fielder going to a different team in the middle of an offseason before you even get to the winter meetings. You didn't really, you know, get the sense that that was, you know, a hotly contested player to be moved. And so is this the most value they could have gotten? I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think there are some mitigating factors, none the least of which is that, I mean, Denard Span hasn't played in more than 128 games over the past two seasons. In 2011, he only played in 70 games.
True.
And a lot of his value is tied to his ability to play defense because, you know, he doesn't have a lot of power. I mean, for a speed guy, he didn't have an overwhelming amount of stolen bases last year. But my question now is, how does that outfield shape up in Washington?
Whew, that's a good outfield.
Yeah, no kidding, it's a good outfield. But, you know, a lot of people have been speculating that Michael Morse could be on the trade block just because, you know, there's a log jam out in that outfield. What do you think? Do you think it's left to right? It's Harper, Span, Worth, or what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's best right now because the issue that the Nats are having is Adam LaRoche and re-upping Adam LaRoche. What you could do, correct me if I'm wrong on the contract situations here, but you could shift Morse back to first and then have that outfield of Span, Harper, and Worth and, you know, Bernardine off the bench. But I think that that would be the optimal way to balance this out. I'm pretty sure Morse is still under contract.
Yeah, I believe he is, and I think you're right. That is probably the ideal scenario for the Nationals just because Adam LaRoche is going to command a multi-year deal, despite the fact that he's a, you know, 31-year-old first baseman who's, you know, certainly not in that top tier of mashers at the first base position. But yeah, I think that that's probably what the Nationals will try to do. Maybe they try to extend LaRoche. I don't really see that happening. I see him testing the waters. But yeah, if not, I think that makes Morse expendable, in which case they might try to deal him. So they have a couple of options in terms of how they can configure their outfield in the first base position.
Right, right. Yeah. And what's kind of scary, Bryce Harper is going to be really, really, really good. We haven't even seen the beginning. Well, yeah, I guess we've seen the beginning. But, you know, this is a guy who could be a generational talent, the type of player A-Rod was. And he's going to be 20 on opening day. And he's 4.5 wins above replacement player using BP's metric. Just outrageously good. And he's going to be in right field. I think he was a little bit over his head in center field sometimes this year, especially as he kind of grows into his body. I think right fielder is going to be the best fit for him. So this allows the Nats to move him to right field more permanently and allow him to just focus on being the best right fielder he can be rather than, you know, trying to do all these different things. But yeah, I like Bryce Harper.
Yeah, I'm 21, turning 22, and I'm still waiting to grow into my body. So,
yeah, Bryce Harper was born 2 weeks to the day before I was. So he's
you kid, you babies.
Yeah, he makes it feel weird to watch baseball.
And what was your weighted on base average last year?
I didn't qualify.
You didn't get the 501.
I didn't get the 500. Yeah, exactly. Another weird thing, at BP, we're putting together the prospect rankings right now. We're working on the Pirates. Luis Heredia is one of the Pirates' top prospects. His birthday, August 10th, 1994.
Goodness. I'm August 9th, 91. This is so terrifying to me.
Oh, wow. He's 3 years younger. Oh, wow. Dang.
I don't have anything to say. I'm just... This is so disheartening. Like, yeah, I guess I have to retire my ambitions of being a Major League Baseball player.
I wouldn't give up so easily.
Maybe I can be a post-hype sleeper or something. You know, something like that.
Yeah, I trust you've seen The Rookie.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
There I go. Yeah, you got it.
If you can throw 96 when you're 40, whatever, you know, go for it.
It's possible. I'm not left-handed, though, so that could be, you know, a bit of a obstacle.
Well, who knows where you're going to be in 20 years? Or
that's true.
You might be left-handed then.
That's a good point. So moving on, as we tackle this sort of last subject that we have on the docket, we are officially past the non-tender deadline. So, you know, a number of guys have hit the free agent market because they were not offered contracts from their club. And there are a couple of actually prominent names on that list, highlighted by guys like the eccentric Brian Wilson, Mark Reynolds, Jair Jurgens. So we thought it would be fun to roster bait and, you know, perhaps pick potential destinations that might make sense for them. So, Hudson, I'll throw it over to you, and we'll start with probably the most recognizable name on that list in Brian Wilson. You know, he obviously missed last season with Tommy John surgery. He only appeared in 2 games before going under the knife. Where do you think he ends up, if anywhere?
I think he probably ends up back in San Francisco, just at least for the year. It just makes sense. He's kind of at this point where if he goes anywhere, is he going to be comfortable? He's got this persona in San Francisco that he would have to abandon. And when you look at what he's probably going to be offered on the free agent market, is anyone going to offer him something so much better than what the Giants can that he's going to pick up and leave? He might come back and be just the same pitcher. Even then, he might not be able to win over a closer role in San Francisco. But still, we have this... I don't see him leaving San Francisco, even if there's no guarantee of what he... You know, what role he'll play for the Giants if he returns.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is with the Giants is that their bullpen's actually in pretty good shape without Brian Wilson. I mean, for goodness sake, they won the World Series this year. But, you know, Sergio Romo did a great job filling in Wilson's absence, and then they already shelled out a heck of a lot, in fact, an incomprehensible amount of money to Jeremy Affelt to bring him back, or Affelt, or however it's pronounced. So they've actually invested quite a bit of money into their bullpen already. But, I mean, you're absolutely right. The whole persona thing, Wilson has managed to cultivate, you know, a real cult of personality in San Francisco. He's extremely well-liked. He's a character. You know, he's a draw, the whole fear the beard thing. So I think that that's actually going to work into his advantage if he does opt to negotiate something with the Giants. But, you know, I think that could be an obstacle in terms of him leaving San Francisco just because he's built up such a following there and he's well-liked and, you know, that's been his home. That's really become, you know, his defining club. And I think it always will be even if he leaves. But, yeah, I mean, the Giants could just simply say, you know, we've already spent a lot of money on the bullpen and we're not going to give you what you want kind of thing. And he elects to, you know, pursue another option. But, yeah, Wilson's a very interesting case, and on that note, we'll head on down the list and look at the oft-striking-out Mark Reynolds.
Mark Reynolds is, he's Mark Reynolds. I mean, I don't think that there's a team that sticks out as a fit for Mark Reynolds. I could certainly see him, making his way to Houston. If you look at, the situation down there, they could use a veteran player, for a couple months and then flip that veteran player. So I look at them as kind of a fit for some misfit toys, that guys that do have value on major league teams but don't have the type of value that makes you say, let's go out and sign that guy. It's kind of just guys you'd like to have on your team after July 31st. But I could see Houston as being a good fit. Another place I could see being similar would probably be in the National League West. The Rockies could be a fit, I guess. Just having him in Coors Field would be fun. A lot of home runs, I would imagine. But, you know, I see him as more of a guy who plays for a team that's not expecting to win, and then that team trades him come the end of the season. Probably a one-year deal where he can kind of build some value for himself and then go back onto the market. So I see something like that happening with Mark Reynolds.
Yeah, I could agree with you more. I mean, the thought that doesn't really occur to really good teams. Oh, you know who we need? Mark Reynolds. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not something that ever pops into their minds, probably because, you know, there are a lot of holes in his game, you know, outside of the power. So, yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And moving on down, the next one we have is Jair Jurgens.
Jair Jurgens would be a really, really good fit for the Angels, I think. I think he's a guy who I don't think any team can really justify giving him a guaranteed contract at this point. He was awesome a couple years ago. But a lot of that was, I don't want to say due to luck, but things, you know, the ball bounced in his favor a lot when he had that really great season. And, you know, you look at the numbers from this past season, 48 and third innings pitched, 19 strikeouts, 18 walks, 6.89 ERA. It's just it wasn't good. It wasn't good at all. And so you're kind of banking on him returning to this guy who strikes out like 5 batters per 9 and walks, I think, like 3, versus then walking and striking out 3 scenario that he had in 2012. And that's kind of unrealistic in my opinion. But if you give this guy a minor league deal, maybe you catch fire in a bottle. And do get another couple good years out of him. He's still young. This will be his age 27 season. So, but for me, I just can't see guaranteeing a contract for Jair Jurgens.
No, it's not a prudent move, and I would be very shocked if some team did it. But I actually think he makes sense for the Blue Jays, considering, as I mentioned earlier, their lack of rotational depth. You know, he could even conceivably fight for that fifth rotation spot with Jay Happ, although I you know, he'd have to have such an exceptional spring performance mm-hmm. to supplant Happ. But yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, he is very young. And I mean, last year there's no excuses. He was terrible, but you look at the batting average on balls in play, it was a relatively astronomical 354. And I mean, that's as equally unsustainable as what he did back in 2009 when he was so dominant at 268. So, I mean, the hope for any, you know, prospective employer of Jair Jurgens is that it stabilizes somewhere. Hopefully that strikeout rate comes, you know, into the 6 range, and he can keep the walks down and, you know, keep the ground balls up. So I'm not prepared to say that Jair Jurgens is done because, no. You know, you're right. He's entering his age 27 season and, you know, that's generally considered to be a player's prime. So I think that there is still something there. But a guaranteed move probably doesn't make sense for any team right now, as you said. I'm just reiterating all your points because you are so insightful.
I get that a lot.
and handsome.
Yeah, I get that a lot too. I feel like a tremendous douche right now.
I feel like that a lot of the time.
Yeah, I get that a lot. Yeah. So another guy who was non-tendered, the Derp King, Jeff Karstens. Jeff Karstens is going to be a free agent. I think Jeff Karstens might be the best option of any of the non-tendered players out there. What are your thoughts on Karstens and where he might be a good fit?
Yeah, I don't disagree. Any team that's looking for a back of the end starter, this is probably a more bankable bet than Jair Jurgens.
Right.
They're quite similar in that they don't strike out a lot of guys, you know, between 5 and 6 per 9. Karstens has a little better command, over the past two seasons, actually. The last three seasons, he's had a walk rate under 2 per 9, which is quite good. I mean, you worry about the home runs. The dip in ground ball rate last year was a little bit alarming. But for the most part, Karstens has some value. According to Fangraphs, Wins Above Replacement, he had the best year of his career last year. Mm-hmm. He's a decent option for teams that are desperate for help. And he might come cheaper than some of those other free agent starters who could provide a similar function. You know, guys like Joe Saunders or Joe Blanton or, mm-hmm. guys like that who, they aren't going to wow you with anything. But, for the most part, they'll come out and do the job. So what was your take on Karstens?
I agree with you. I think he's a guy who you kind of can see slotting into the back of a rotation pretty cheaply and having a really good season under the radar. Over the past 2 years, he's actually been really, really effective. I think if you get him on the mound for 25 to 30 starts and he's your fourth or fifth guy, that's not a bad deal. And especially when you look at what he's probably going to cost, he's been very predictable. His performance has been pretty consistent over the past 3 years, really. And so I look at him as kind of a guy that could be a nice little steal for somebody. And I think that there's going to be a good deal of interest in adding him as a back-end starter, and that might drive his price up a little bit. And I wouldn't be surprised at all to find out that or to know that Jeff Karstens makes more money this offseason than he otherwise would have in arbitration. So I think Jeff Karstens is probably pretty satisfied right now.
Probably. Who has more appeal as a non-tender pickup candidate, Karstens or John Lannon, in your mind?
I would probably go with Karstens. Lannon, I think Lannon is going to try to command more money. And I also think that Lannon is a guy who we only saw throw four games this year?
Six games last year.
Okay, as I fidget my way to his Fangraphs page. Yeah, okay, so six starts. He was never particularly good. It's always been kind of bleh.
But he's never been terrible. That's the thing about John Lannon is that, he has really, really high ground ball rates. He's never going to do anything sexy, but he's also never been terrible throughout his career. And, he's had, between 2008 and 2011, he had four consecutive seasons of making at least 25 starts, and in three of those seasons, he made more than 30 starts. And, his numbers are not bad. He had a sub-4 ERA in three of those four seasons. The FIP suggests that maybe he got a little bit lucky, but, he has high ground ball rates. He doesn't walk too many guys, and he keeps the ball in the ballpark. So, and he throws with his left hand. So, if you throw with your left hand, sure, and you have a pulse, you're always appealing to a major league team. And, he might come at a discount considering how little he played last year. So I actually think that John Lennon could be rather appealing to any team who, again, is looking for back of the rotation help and back of the rotation consistency.
Yeah, but does he have that dirt quality that Jeff Karstens has?
No, he does not.
And so that's where we're at with this. Two guys who fit in the back of the rotation. One of them has more durability than any player has ever had. And then there's John Lennon, who I'm sure there's some derp there. I haven't scouted the derp, but I think it's pretty clear that Jeff Karstens has the edge in derp.
Well, you've got a derp. You've got to.
Yeah, to be a successful major leaguer. yeah. Okay, so, Jonah, I think we can kind of move on. And I think we ought to probably take a break first, and then we can come back and recap what our weeks have looked like and what our lives look like over the next several days.
Love it.
We'll be right back. Stick around.
Never tell what you wanted from me, babe. I feel you down deep inside.
Welcome back to the Tools of Ignorance podcast. Here we are on the precipice of finishing another episode. So without too much preamble, Hudson, what's going on in your life right now?
I am busy. I had Thanksgiving and I was traveling and in New Jersey where my family lives. Then I'm back at school and finals, and there's one piece that I'm working on for Baseball Prospectus that is probably going to be my shining moment.
Your magnum opus.
My magnum opus, if you will. It's on Canadian baseball and the development of baseball in Canada, culturally speaking, and it captures a lot of the experiences of some very famous Canadian players, and I've scouted a few Canadian players. I've got good scouting contacts in Canada, and so there's actually something pretty interesting. The Jays just recently announced that in September of next year, they will have a sort of like a scouting combine at the Rogers Centre. So that'll be interesting. I may travel up to Toronto for that.
You can stay at my house if you want.
Interesting. So Canadian baseball, I'm also doing a lot of stat work for it, which is taking a lot longer than I would have anticipated. But I'm looking at things like I compiled a database of every Canadian-born player who's ever been drafted. And I'm looking at career warp and sort of looking at if certain teams draft better in Canada than others. Maybe kids from Ontario turn out to be better big leaguers than kids from British Columbia. Maybe not. Maybe it's the opposite.
Yeah, I'd say it's probably the opposite.
Brent Lowry's pretty good. I'm also doing... I'm just keeping up with my Angel stuff, and I'm just blogging and doing whatever. I'm about 7 days removed from, or away from being on break, at which time I will begin to undertake a number of projects, both on the blogosphere and behind the scenes for some things. And then we inch closer and closer to baseball coming back. So that's my life in a nutshell, Jonah. How about you? How are you?
See, I always feel bad because, like, my plans always pale in comparison to yours. You're like, oh, I'm going to run for governor. I'm going to become king of you know, the baseball world. And me, it's like, yeah, I'm going to sit at home and, you know, watch TV. Not quite. I didn't get to enjoy Thanksgiving festivities because I am not American. So, you know, ours was a number of months back. And outside of that, yeah, just trying to keep up on the blog. And I'm plugging myself here, which I don't think I've done since episode one.
Go ahead.
So, yeah, if you want to follow along my thoughts on what's happening in the world of the Blue Jays, hit me up at touchemalltoronto.blogspot.com. And outside of that, I am, unlike Hudson, I am still 13 days away from break. So I'm very much looking forward to that. And yes, like you, I am preparing to hibernate until opening day. So we'll look forward to that. And on that note, let us just remind our listeners that, listen, next week we really want to answer a number of your questions out here on the podcast. So please hit us up at toolsofignorance11@gmail.com. And on that note, we bid you a fond farewell.
Adios. Cool.
Cool. I want you.